If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In today's episode, you'll be hearing from the historian Ian Mortimer. He's the author of a series of time travellers' guides that take readers into the streets, smells and experiences of different eras. And his latest is a guide to Regency Britain. Though popular depictions of the era often focus on the middle and upper class worlds, such as those depicted by Jane Austen. But the chasm between rich and poor at this time was hugely significant and can't be ignored. Putting the questions to Ian was our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
So your time traveller's guide to Regency Britain tells readers everything they need to know about many elements of the Georgian era, such as criminals, disease, beggars, hardship and inequality, for example. But perhaps that isn't the first thing we think about when we think about this era, perhaps thanks to Austen, thanks to Regency architecture and so on. Can you introduce the listeners to your book and to your approach to the era?
Yeah. Now, the idea of a time traveller's guide is that you actually can go there and see it for yourself. So if you could go to Regency Britain, what you can see, what you can eat, what you can smell, how are people going to treat you, which diseases might affect you, which doctors might kill you, etc. It's an immersive approach, which is an attempt to do two things, really. Firstly, it's an attempt to make this period really accessible and exciting and open people's eyes to what was going on at all levels of society. And secondly, it's an attempt to allow people to see how they can contextualise their own time, what it's like to be alive in any age, not just then. Most history is about a particular point in time viewed without the complications of other times. The Time Traveller's Guide series is an attempt to do what I introduced in the first book, which was it derives from a line from W.H. Auden. He said, in order to understand your own country, you need to have lived in at least two others. And in my case, I introduced the idea that in order to understand your own time, you need to have come to terms with at least two others. So this is the fourth period. And by looking at Regency, by looking at the previous books, which were medieval, Elizabethan, Restoration, I'm hoping that people can understand what it's like to be alive in any age. And so it's a deeper level is doing that. So it's history doing two things at once. But as you say, we're overwhelmed by images of elegance and Jane Austen-like refinement and politeness. And that period is so attractive for those reasons. But something I just said, all parts of society. This book does go a long way beyond the Jane Austen world. Jane Austen's an exceptionally good writer, and she introduces the interplay of the upper middle class and the lower upper class beautifully, and their fears and their hopes and aspirations and the personal elements involved. But there's an awful lot of Regency Britain that she would simply not have known about, because the slums of Liverpool, where perhaps 700-800 people are crammed in per acre, living in squalor, is something that she would not want to, would not have wanted to know about, because most people didn't. Even people went to Liverpool didn't see it. So this is an exploration of a very different Regency from the one normally portrayed on your television screens.
Right. So it's a vast scope of history that you're looking at. And as you say, this is the fourth time you've done this, the fourth era you've looked at in this way. And how do you start looking at an era like this? Where do you begin? How do you decide what elements to include for the reader?
I often say, when you answer the question, where do you begin, by saying you have to go for a long walk, because so much of this comes from thinking through where we stand. What do people already know? In real terms, I mean, it starts from a lot of reading, because there is an awful lot of material there to be discovered in people's diaries, in official accounts. But there's also an awful lot to be discovered through being in the places, looking at the art. So the process of writing one of these books is as immersive as the text hopefully will be for its readers. I do visit the sites. I do listen to an awful lot of the music from the time. I start off one of the processes by buying a whole load of coins from the period, because coins are works of art, but they've threaded their way through people's pockets and purses and bought milk and bread and houses and bandages and sex or what is paid for everything. And yet these things are works of art, and they come down intact to us. And I treasure them as emblems of people's lives, which those smiling king's faces that have seen so many things that happen over the years. So it's a whole multiplicity of things, but it's a very immersive process, writing a time traveler's guide. And I've got to say, the actual writing is a delight, but it's also very, very difficult, because you have to pretend to know everything.
Well, the coin seems like a really interesting place to start. And touching upon that, your account picks up on the fact that there's this vast wealth inequality. Lots of people had many coins, some people didn't have as many. What can you say about the vast wealth inequality of this period and how it marks the era that you're writing about?
It is astonishing, the difference of rich and poor. This is something you really do get from Jane Austen when you read the text closely, in the fear in the upper middle classes. They'll sink down that social spectrum and won't have the money for their own carriage. They won't be able to provide the privileged positions for their children. There are two ways, really, of looking at the wealth inequality, and most people are going to understand the very nature of wealth inequality in our own, in respect of our own times, where we see extraordinary wealth inequality. And if we consider the Jeff Bezos of this world and the super, super rich, you know, your people who are worth more than £20 billion, well, they are, in terms of multiples of what people can earn per year, they are way out there. There's no inequality in Regency quite to compare with the super, super rich of the modern world. However, that is a very, very few, small number of people. If you look at people generally, if you compare the upper class and the upper middle class of Regency Britain, so really the top 1.5% in terms of income, with the 50% to 70% of the working class, that inequality is far greater than its equivalent today. So that inequality then between the upper classes on average, upper middle classes on average, and the working class on average, it's roughly works out at around 26, 27 times as much income for the upper and middle classes as for the working class. Today, if you compare the top 1% with the bottom 50%, the multiple is about 6.5 times. So there's much less inequality for most people in society today. And if you look at what people could actually afford to buy in the Regency, this comes across very, very starkly. If you, for example, if you look at prices using the Bank of England's inflation calculator and extrapolate from that, what could people actually buy? What purchasing power did they have? You realise that an awful lot of working class families, in fact, the average working class family, is getting on by on a modern income that would be about £3,500 a year, maybe £4,000 a year. That's your average working class family. And when you look at their diets, you realise how tight things were. They can't afford to eat meat. They frequently can't afford to drink beer. They drink tea, which is reusing the tea leaves. They get byred by sweetening it and drinking it with milk, not because that's the way they want it, but that is because that's the only way to make palatable drink that they can afford. Brush lights are very affordable ways of lighting, but they're smelly and dirty, and their standard of living is, we would consider, appalling. And it's really to the credit of the people that so many of them got by in such circumstances. The inequality of society is it truly horrifying. And when you start looking in some of the slum areas, then you will recoil in horror.
You already mentioned Liverpool. Where else in Britain would you have kind of found these conditions? And what did you find out about life expectancy in this period as well?
Well, any industrial town is going to be a challenge to get by in if you're a working class person or even lower middle class. The society was not geared up for the benefit of every member. The Ancien Régime, that's before the Great Reform Act, before our slow equivalent of the French Revolution, which is more representation in government. Before all that, the government really is operating for the benefit of the proprietors of the land, the upper middle classes and the upper classes, and obviously the institution, the monarchy itself. So it's not trying to look after anybody in an industrial town. So if you're in Manchester, or if you're in Liverpool, or if you're in Glasgow, or Preston, or Ashton-under-Lyne, or the Potteries, wherever you are in England, which is industrial, you have this great problem that the very wealth of the place starts to impoverish the workers. It's a huge irony, but you see it happen all over the place. Basically, the prosperity and the jobs on offer attract newcomers who have got nothing to sell but their labour. They're working for wages. So they move to these places, and then they have to compete with everybody else for what unskilled labour there is, or skilled labour if they're lucky. So they will inevitably, by going there, have driven down the wages being paid because employers can get away with paying less. And at the same time, this population expansion in these industrial towns means that the landed proprietors who own the land around charge extra for developing the land. So a plot that in Liverpool would have been a house and garden, now becomes three houses along the front with a passage underneath, and eight houses and where the garden would have been. And you end up with several hundred people living in these houses, and an intensity of occupation, all trying to earn as much money as possible, all prepared to do practically anything to earn a crust. As a result, if you're working class in Liverpool in this period, life expectancy at birth sinks to about 16. If you're in Preston or Ashton-under-Lyne or places like that, you can see in the unsewered streets, the really poor areas, life expectancy at birth sink to below 14, which is the lowest I've come across anywhere in any time in this country. And I would be surprised if you could find lower expectations of birth anywhere else in the world.
Right, yeah, there's some pretty staggering statistics there. Obviously, there are lots of factors contributing to this life expectancy. And you've already mentioned the industrial towns that many found themselves in this period. What sort of burgeoning industries did many find themselves working in, and what sort of new health risks were they posing?
Well, the new industries is the manufacturing. I mean, Britain's not known as the workshop of the world. is the workshop of the world at this period. I mean, it's the cotton manufacturing, woolens, factories driven by water, factories driven by steam. Obviously, these then require further industries to support them. So the coal industry takes off much more. The risks they're facing are both to health and disease and injury. And the diseases aren't just infectious diseases, which are rife in areas where you have slum accommodation, but there are also diseases of dust. Across the whole 19th century, probably the biggest occupational health threat to people is dust. And in the places where you can have gas lighting and therefore the steam engines that are powering these places running 24 hours a day, the heat is incredible, the dust is incredible, and the lung diseases that are a result are truly horrific. But then there's the injuries as well, as young people often, workers in factories are very often young, they simply don't get a chance to grow up. They get drawn into machines and suffer terrible injuries. As one vivid case in the memoirs of Robert Blinko, a 10-year-old girl got drawn into a cotton machine, and it drew her in and then threw her around. And Blinko describes her blood being thrown around like as if it was water twirled from a mop, which is a very evocative image. And, you know, the mental damage too, the mental state of these people must have been terrible. And as far as life expectancy goes, now if you're in the cutlery industries, especially in Sheffield, you are old in that profession if you make it to 28. 90% are dead by 40 and 100% are dead by 50. It's a horrific time to be working class and desperate to sell your labour. So, you can carry on like this. I mean, the coal mines, whatever it is, whichever way you look, the lack of care for the working man and woman in society, it is truly appalling.
Hmm. You make this distinction in your book between rural and urban poverty. And I guess we're perhaps guilty of idealising rural life as idyllic or, romanticising it a little bit. What was the case for poorer people living in rural settings?
They're much better off because they have space and they have fresh air. They have ventilation. They are not crowded in by dust. The space is actually a frequently underestimated quality to rural living. You haven't got to, frankly, wade across sort of 6 inches of excrement to get to your front door or back door, whichever. You know, there is ways of getting rid of things. There are water supplies. There are firewood supplies that mean you don't have to break up a door or steal a door from someone in order to try and keep warm. There are many more facilities when you have space. Life expectancy, as a result, is much, much higher in the countryside than it is in the industrial towns. You're looking at 35 to 40 life expectancy at birth in a county like I'm living in now, Devon. So you're far better off. On the other hand, wages are very, very low for agricultural labourers. And there is a marked distinction between your prosperous yeoman who owns his own land and can bring in an income of maybe excess of £200 a year, sometimes much more than that, through employing agricultural labourers, and those agricultural labourers themselves, who in the 1790s, 1800s, would probably be working for 8 shillings a week, something like that, and women probably for about half to two-thirds of that, and children for a fraction of that. So many people go into the services, work as servants, because that way at least they're given board and lodging, which keeps body and soul together, obviously. But then you might not be paid very much at all, £3 a year or something like that. So the rural lot is very tough too. Having said that, I mean, the visitors who come here look at English cottages and think they are beautiful, picturesque. And so the foreigner's impression is that our rural folk live in some degree of refinement. When you go in those houses, though, and look at what they have and how they live, you'll realise it's tough.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
and most crucially, judges thereafter were able to give lesser penalties. They didn't have to hang somebody who was found guilty of a capital offence. And that's really important, because until then, even if you were 7 years of age, if the penalty had been capital, or the crime had been a capital offence, the judge had to sentence you to death. So after 1823, we start to see the light. It's a momentous act.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Yes, it sounds tough all round. And what kind of welfare or charitable help was on offer at this time? Was there any sense of social responsibility, or did that come a bit later on?
Social responsibility is there, but it has evolved over the centuries from the medieval idea that the donor of money for the poor is doing it for the benefit of his soul or her soul, rather than the benefit of the person, the poor people to whom you give. It's almost as if the poor are a vehicle for the souls of the rich. Now, in this country, we took a lead in this in the 16th century with the rise of Puritanism and the eventual passing of the great Poor Law Act of, first one 1597, then 1601, whereby communities were forced to tax local incomes in order to pay for the poor of a parish, which is a truly remarkable social development. And it meant that 100 years later, when there were a series of terrible famines across Europe, everywhere in Europe saw its population literally decimated, reduced by a tenth. France saw 2 million people starve to death. Scandinavia did. Scotland saw a tenth of its population either starve or emigrate. England did not see that terrible toll on its population. So the poor law, the old poor law, has kept going. And that, in this period, is still active. It's very expensive now for local landowners. They have to pay a fair bit towards the upkeep of the poor. And that money goes towards maintaining indoor relief, that's the workhouse, or outdoor relief, that's payments to people who are able to earn a bit of money outside their own homes. So if you're a widow with six children you wouldn't have any way of working for enough money to feed a family that size, but you could apply to the overseer of the poor for outdoor relief in order to help you feed them. It won't help you with anything else other than food, really, because the money given is a pittance, but it does help people survive.
Hmm. You mentioned, for example, a struggling widow there, or a struggling family with children. And one particularly shocking aspect of this extreme poverty that struck me were the burial clubs. Could we talk about those?
Oh, yes. Yeah, my instinct is to say, do we have to? Because they are in some ways, they're almost iconic in the, or archetypal, that's a better word to use, archetypal in the degree of sadness and depression that comes upon the working class in this country at that time. A burial club is basically an insurance organization whereby you pay a small amount of money to insure your child in case it should die, or he or she should die, but he or she will have a proper Christian burial. What a number of working class families do is insure their children in several burial clubs so that they can actually cash in by the child dying. It's recorded in one 1830s report that if a child was enrolled with a burial club, he or she had a 35% chance of dying in infancy than if he wasn't, or she wasn't enrolled. So people are effectively allowing their children to die so they can actually get some money, or they're killing them in order to get some money. And the latter is so shocking to society that the government does have some inspections to see whether this is really going on, and finds, yes, there are cases where people are practicing infanticide in order to feed the other children. And it is so basic and yet repugnant to all civilized sensibilities that it really is quite disturbing. There are cases of the one sticks in my mind of a wet nurse who was working for a gentlewoman, and her child was ill, and the gentlewoman said to the wet nurse, "Oh, I will send my physician to see to the child." And the wet nurse says, "Oh, don't worry, ma'am, it's enrolled in two burial clubs." In other words, no matter what happens, we're prepared for it. And rent collectors get told to wait until children die in order to pay the rent, things like this. So at the bottom of society, for the absolute desperate, those who have got nothing, you are talking about matters of life and death that are truly horrific.
Yes, indeed. Pretty horrible stuff. And I'm afraid my next question doesn't lift the mood much. I wanted to ask about the so-called Bloody Code, the brutal system of justice that existed at this time. What was that?
Well, the Bloody Code is the word we use historically to describe a whole raft of legislation, mostly passed in the early 18th century, to deter people from turning to crime, and mostly theft. And the number of people who are arrested for theft, as opposed to any other crime in this period, is far higher. I mean, looking at 90% of people who have tried being charged with crimes relating to theft in some way or other. And you can see, if you've got so little money, so little food, you can understand why people do thieve. Now, the Bloody Code is best understood as a result of a way of thinking that is exemplified by Lord Halifax in the 1690s, when he uttered the famous phrase, "Men are not hanged for stealing horses, but that horses may not be stolen." Now, that idea of deterrent, it really fuels people's thinking that the greater the penalty you have to pay if you are caught, the less likely you are to commit a crime. Now, we have a totally different way of thinking. We have the philosophy that the greater the likelihood it is that you will get caught, the more unlikely it is you'll commit a crime. If you know you're going to get caught for something, you won't even attempt the crime. But then very few people, there were very few ways of tracking down, detecting criminals, etc. So therefore, this idea of deterrence, that you'll hang virtually everybody, is prevalent. And you can get hanged for consorting with gypsies, being out at night with a blacked-up face, damaging a pond, damaging a highway. You know, these are hanging offences. And anything to do with theft, you know, gamekeepers have the right to shoot you dead for trespassing on private property if they believe they are going after game. So there is a real problem for people who are forced to turn to crime. Now, the fact is, by 1800, there's something like 200 capital offences on the statute books. And at this point, enters Sir Samuel Romilly, a wholly good man in my estimations, because he campaigned tirelessly in order to get rid of the Bloody Code. And he introduced, I think, 5 bills to get rid of the penalty, the penalty of hanging for shoplifting. And he was unsuccessful every single time, but he nevertheless kept on hammering it home in the House of Commons that it's not acceptable just to hang people for every crime. And fortunately, his work was taken up by Robert Peel, who in 1823 passed an act which meant not only did most of the Bloody Code no longer result in hanging of capital punishment, but also, and most crucially, judges thereafter were able to give lesser penalties. They didn't have to hang somebody who was found guilty of a capital offence. And that's really important, because until then, even if you were 7 years of age, if the penalty had been a capital, or the crime had been a capital offence, the judge had to sentence you to death. So after 1823, we start to see the light. It's a momentous act.
Okay. Well, aside from what you're just saying there about Romilly's reform, which obviously very positive thing, most of what we talked about has been pretty bleak. And I want... But perhaps I can ask about a happier subject. Was there any opportunity for social mobility? Any examples of people changing their station or bettering themselves in this period?
Well, yes. It's an extraordinary period on that note. I mean, a lot of the self-made, we would call them multimillionaires. We would think of them as billionaires. But the people like James Morrison, who was the... a younger child of an innkeeper, I think he was an orphan of an innkeeper in Hampshire or Wiltshire or somewhere like that. He worked his way up to join a haberdashery company in London, married the senior partner's daughter, took control of the company. By 1830, he was worth about £1 million. By the time of his death, he was worth £6 million. £6 million in the 19th century is a phenomenal fortune. So people could come from nothing to being one of the richest people in Europe or in the world. There are cases. Philip Rundle was an apprentice from Norton St. Philip in Somerset. He became an apprentice jeweller. And when he retired, he was worth about, I think it was £1.5 million, somewhere in that region, £1.3 million, something like that. So there are people who come from nothing. And perhaps Harriet Mellon's story is the most extraordinary of all, because she was the illegitimate daughter of an Irish peasant woman who had a job in England looking after the costumes of actors and actresses as they trooped around the north. And, he was coming from such a background, he wouldn't have thought things looked that optimistic. But Harriet could act a little bit, and she came to the attention of Richard Brinsley Sheridan, who cast her in a role in London, and so she took up acting, and she didn't do badly at it. She was earning about £600 a year from her acting at one stage, but she also caught the eye of Thomas Coutts of Coutts Bank. Thomas Coutts asked Harriet Mellon to marry him, and she said yes, despite him being about twice her age in the 70s. They had a very happy marriage for a little while, and when he died, he left control of Coutts Bank to her. So she ran the bank in her own name. And when she remarried to the Duke of Buckingham, she was therefore a duchess, but also had her own fortune in the bank. So had a fortune of something in the region of £1.5-2 million. So extraordinary rags to riches story there. Obviously, she incurred the envy and wrath of virtually every other society lady there was. They were very, very snooty about her. But nevertheless, she seemed very happy with both her husband, and certainly was far better off than when she started in life. All the way through, you can find people in some way or other bettering themselves. Obviously, some people lose large amounts of money. But if you can make that break out of the working classes and to a position of where you are able to have a certain dignity and you want to earn that much more, there are frequently opportunities for people to do so, whether through trade or marriage or whatever. So, yeah, there are people who can join the high life. And boy, in this period, was it a high life. The style is wonderful.
Absolutely. You mentioned, you've talked about Romilly's reform already, and I wondered what other changes in attitude or societal change more generally eventually begin to address these extremes of inequality or bring it to more of a close, or where do you choose to end it in your book, for example?
Well, we have to remember here the entire Regency period, and I'm talking here about 1789 through to 1830, I should have said that right at the start, that's all in the wake of the French Revolution and those ideas of equality and fraternity and liberty, which are enshrined in that momentous event. Now, that means people are constantly rethinking whether it's right to own slaves or trade in slaves. Is it right to be anti-Semitic? People are thinking, is it right that women should not have certain rights? People are thinking all the way through a lot of these conundrums, moral problems, for the first time. I mean, the most obvious answer to this question is radicalism and reform, the whole idea of representation and whether people should have the vote or not. And increasing pressure through the mass gatherings, and especially in industrial towns in the north and to a certain extent in London, for there to be one man, one vote, it changes people's attitudes to what government is for. And by 1832, in the Great Reform Act, that has actually changed attitudes, not entirely, but very substantially, in that there is merit in extending the franchise and for the government to look at more interests than simply those of the major landowners. So, yes, and not just the attitudes against minorities, but also the responsibilities of government itself, I think, I would say, are a key attitude change of this period.
That was Ian Mortimer. The Time Traveller's Guide to Regency Britain is published by Bodley Head and is out now. Ian also wrote a feature on Regency Britain for the December 2020 issue of BBC History Magazine. You can read that on our website at historyextra.com/regency-inequality. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow for a conversation about werewolves in the ancient world.